football on Off the Ball.
And sadly, Irish football, out of the 55 federations, when you line them all up, is the third most underperforming nation.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Formula One Pod on Off the Ball. Brought to you by KitKat. Hit pause, have a break,
have a KitKat.
Hello and welcome to the F1 Pod on Off the Ball. It is our first full F1 Pod of the season after the Australian Grand Prix, and we are delighted to have KitKat on as a sponsor for this year. So the F1 Pod on Off the Ball is brought to you by KitKat, bringing breaks to the fastest sport in the world. Hashtag have a break. I'm also excited to be joined as ever by Ciara Tracy to the left of me. Ciara, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. It's so good to be here. Lots to talk about.
And we are joined on the line by motorsport journalist Declan Quigley. Declan, how are you?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, absolutely great. And hi, Ciara as well. Yeah, it's been we had a great race last weekend, so we're all up and running now. It's good.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say it was a great race because I had a good time watching it. But I think there's been some divided opinions, perhaps, on the quality of the racing itself. So to go straight into it, I guess this is a whole new era of F1, new regulations, and we're seeing the first time the way that overtakes and racing wheel to wheel is working with these new regulations. Some drivers, some fans saying that that fight between Russell and Leclerc for the lead was artificial. But I mean, I personally, I had a good time watching it. I can understand people's qualms, but what did you think?
I didn't mind it, to be honest. I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was better than I was expecting. I think that's where I would come down. And it was entertaining because the issue was in doubt and we didn't know who had the fastest car and we didn't know who was going to win the race for the first third of the race. And that was certainly not expected because I think that you couldn't back George Russell, could you, ahead of it? Certainly not the Mercs. They were going to just cruise off into the sunset and take the first half a dozen race wins and it'd all be finished by halfway. Doesn't quite look like that at the moment. They got their 1-2 finish, but yeah, we got a race. We got the old bungee cord racing, didn't we, where sort of they seemed to be attached by elastic bands. One would go past, then the other one would get a run, then the other one would get a run. Some people would say that's not real racing, but you could equally argue we haven't had real racing since DRS arrived in 2011, so which some crumbly, crusty old traditionalists might say is not proper car racing. But then things change, don't they? Weirdly, I think this is almost like sports car racing used to be, in that the driver is kind of slightly behind the vehicle, or at least they're ahead of the vehicle. The vehicle's behind them a little bit. They're easily able to manage the pace that they need to go on track, and it's all about trying to manage the resources that allow them to go as fast. So they're kind of tiptoeing around it and trying to manage those energy resources via the battery and playing with all sorts of aerodynamic gizmos as well. And that's a little bit unusual. We have experienced that in the 50s, 60s and 70s with sports car racing, where they were all the time tiptoeing around trying to make sure the brakes didn't fail and that the engine didn't go off song and that the gearbox didn't fall out the back of the car and the driver, you know, felt that they could go a lot quicker if they were just given one lap. And that's kind of the sort of Formula One racing that we've got at the moment. But I think everyone has to understand that modern Formula One racing, well, modern motor racing, it always was the case that you need an automobile, and a driver's championship is a team's championship, always was, always will be. And the driver needs to be able, there's so much more than braking, shift down, turn in, accelerate, and being able to do that. There's so many other inputs, so many other things that they have to take on board. The tactical considerations around tyre management, they've got everything that's happening around them with the other cars they're racing against. Then, of course, the extra layer that they've got now with battery management and all the various different ways that they're, you know, scooping and recouping energy, and then having to deploy that in a racing situation. And that was the first time we saw it last weekend. It's the first time the drivers had a chance to use it, and they all learnt so much as well. I thought it was fascinating. Was it all in absolutely thrilling? No, but that's not what you always get, is it? I mean, not every drama is going to give you thrills and spills all the, you know, from the opening act right through to the closing curtain, is it?
Declan, can I actually pull you up there on a couple of things you say? Because you said the elastic band kind of theory between the cars going between each other there, and also, like you say, we have to now consider the new management of battery power in the new era of these new regulations. Do you think we could see something like perhaps a bit of a predictability between the same kind of strategy? We're going to have let one car, say, let George go for a while, and then we'll see Charles go then. It's going to be a case of the two just deploy, recharge. And will it, we see a, perhaps this kind of continual, you know, let someone cruise for a while, and then you can just get hammer on the battery until it comes to the last moment, and then you just, you know, give it all. Do you think it could be quite predictable strategy-wise if it's just a case of recuperate battery and unleash?
Well, I mean, the one thing that they will do is adjust. They will figure out exactly how this works, and it will change. So what you saw last Sunday is not going to be the way it prevails all the way to the end of the year. I mean, a couple of things are going to happen. One, everyone's going to get the hang of battery management. Two, the cars are going to develop, so they'll have, you know, they'll be changing in their relative competitiveness between them. Three, well, a whole bunch of other things as well. But basically, fundamentally, I 100% agree with you. I think we're going to see a situation whereby drivers decide not to overtake, and they decide to stay in there, you know, for a while and see how things develop. But, you know, conversely, you could see a situation where Ferrari and Mercedes have such an advantage. Relatively, they're quite close. They may feel they need to try and ditch the Red Bulls and the McLarens as best they can. So they might develop a scenario where they actually work together, almost like the old slipstreamers that we used to see in the days before the wings, you know, arrived in Formula 1, or indeed the sort of thing you would see in Formula Ford 1600 racing even today, where they don't have wings, they'll get involved in slipstreamers and they'll work between themselves, almost like bicycle racing actually, to try and escape from the peloton. So you could see scenarios like that developing, but what's absolutely certain is that there will be have been such an array, such a raft of data accumulated by all of the teams, that they'll have such a renewed understanding, even ahead of Shanghai this week, that they, things could well develop and change, and that what happened last week and isn't going to happen all year. It was fascinating, but it was just the start.
I'm glad you mentioned again Ferrari there, because obviously looking back at last weekend, a Mercedes 1-2 and then Leclerc with them on the podium, but Ferrari's start in particular, that kind of the speed they had off the line, the reaction that they have off the line, seems to me at least that's going to be such a huge advantage for them, at least initially in these first few races before teams kind of do their little tweaks and develop kind of further. Will Maranello be perhaps more confident than they've been at this stage of the season, at the very beginning, than they have in recent years?
I think the gauge of that is the Lewis Hamilton smilometer, and that was definitely up towards 100, wasn't it? You know, compared to the end of last season. I mean, everyone said at the end of last year, "Oh, is Lewis Hamilton going to retire?" And quite a few people, including myself, said he will retire if this car turns out to be rubbish. But he was definitely going to try it out. He seemed pretty pleased. Okay, he finished behind Leclerc, but he was closing at the end. Definitely felt like he could have done him. Heading to a race actually that he generally goes well at in Shanghai. So we'll see how that one plays out this weekend. But yeah, I think Ferrari are going to be relatively happy. They were on defensive about their tactics. I mean, it's always the story, isn't it, with Ferrari? What's their pit wall like? What's their strategy ability? You know, sometimes you get paralysed a little bit, particularly when you have track position, and that's what happened to them. We've seen it with other teams. We've seen it with McLaren last year as well. If you're out front, you've got track position, it's very difficult to give that up. But it was a surprise to see that they didn't send at least one car to pit lane when the Isaac Hajar virtual safety car scenario developed, even though it was a long, long way to the flag from there. Tougher for Ferrari to do a whole, or you know, three quarters of a race on one set of tyres, easier for tyre whisperer George Russell to manage it. Antonelli did pretty well as well, didn't he, in fairness in that regard. But yeah, Ferrari, I think in general, will feel that they are thereabouts. Their start advantage that you talk about, there's a couple of factors there as well, and we probably don't really know. I mean, we only ever really know a fraction of what the teams know, and they too only really know a fraction of what the other teams have. But fundamentally, that little turbo that spools up really quickly and gets them going is an advantage for Ferrari. They were off the start line like a rocket. They were haired away. A little bit more complicated for Lewis Hamilton, but he managed to thread his way through on the first lap. For Charles Leclerc, he was absolutely flying. There's nothing like track position. I mean, honestly, if you have a qualifying edge. It puts you up front. You can see with Max Verstappen, he probably would have been better than sixth if he wasn't chasing from the back. So even with these huge gaps between the teams that prevail now compared to the gaps that we saw in 2025 and in previous years, even with that situation, I think track position is a huge advantage. So yeah, absolutely, Ferrari have a major ace in the hole. But the one thing you'd say is that I can't see a scenario where the Mercedes arrive on the grid with virtually no battery and that they're sort of chugging off the line with the internal combustion engine and trying to sort of recharge on the first lap. It's hard to imagine that that's going to prevail through to the end of the season, and you kind of think that they'll have that figured out already by the time they get to Shanghai. So maybe the relative advantage of Ferrari on the starts might not quite be the same. We'll see.
So we see that Mercedes and Ferrari are in a good position starting out, but someone who we're expecting to see a lot more from, given that they dominated last season, is McLaren. What went wrong for McLaren? Obviously, Oscar Piastri had an absolute disaster for his home race. Yet again, he didn't even make it onto the starting line because of a battery torque spike. So what's going to happen with McLaren? They have the same Mercedes engine, but we didn't see anywhere near the same performance. What's gone wrong?
It's early days. They're a customer, aren't they? And there's a lot of talk about the fact that they got the latest spec Merc engine just last minute, which is perfectly, I think, within the rights of the works team, the factory supplier, to sort of give them the engine late on. They have a reputation, actually, as an engine supplier, of being pretty good, Mercedes. So they tend to sort of give exactly the same specification to their customers as they give to their own works team. I think they probably have to, otherwise they wouldn't get the big bucks in supply. But now, they have a pretty good reputation in that regard. What went wrong for McLaren? Well, Oscar Piastri crashed on the outlap to the grid. That's definitely not going to help their cause, and the old curse of the Aussies in Australia continued. They had a spike of, what was it, 100 kilojoules or something, or kilowatts.
It was a
torque spike that caught him out. Was it his fault? I don't know. Things happen. I mean, early days. Again, in relative terms, a couple of drivers had problems ahead. So for Lando Norris, the reigning world champion, finishing fifth is probably nothing to get terribly excited about. He was super disgruntled afterwards. He does not like these new cars. He wants to be winning races. He's the world champion. I can understand where he's coming from with some of his criticism about the cars, actually, about the speed differentials they're going to encounter, and the danger aspect is probably more relevant, I think, as a criticism than the sort of Mario Kart video game criticisms that we're hearing, because racing is racing. You race what you've got. But if there are going to be extra danger aspects to it, that's a little bit different. But I think fundamentally getting that latest spec engine a little bit later, coming to terms with what they've got in terms of energy management, teams will be playing catch up against Mercedes, who seem a little bit more in the zone in that regard, and Ferrari, but I think they're probably not as far off as we think.
Yeah, there was an interesting comment from George Russell in one of the post race interviews. He was asked kind of a leading question, I suppose. Was told Norris wasn't a fan of these engines. Is that just a bit of sour grapes because suddenly Mercedes are doing better than McLaren? And he answered pretty much in that vein, that Mercedes didn't like the cars last year because of the porpoising McLaren did, and now we're into this year and Mercedes really like these cars because they've managed to get an engine and an aero system that's benefiting them, whereas McLaren are struggling that a little bit more. So I suppose that's what we're seeing. It's Formula One changes year on year so much, this year perhaps more than ever, and some teams simply will have adapted better early on.
I mean what you hear from a driver is it's three parts honest opinion and two parts lobbying. So, and it's again what you're hearing on the radio half the time is often what they think, but maybe with an extra emphasis to try and skew opinion a little bit in the corridors of power. So, I mean, absolutely, if you've got a performance deficit, you're going to scream from the rooftops that this is an absolute disgrace for a myriad other reasons, but fundamentally, if myriad other horrible reasons that need to be addressed, but fundamentally, if it brings us back back into the winner's circle, then it's worth shouting about. And absolutely, they hated them, didn't they, the Mercs? They didn't, you know, poor old George Russell, only two wins last season. Now he's a superstar. He loves it. He said, I love this car. I love this engine. I mean, it was, he was laying it on with a trowel at the end, and it was funny to hear. Yeah, zero to hero and hero to zero for the two Brits, but it's the game. And I do find that frustrating, actually. That 99% of everything you hear on the radio is... it always feels a little bit not very genuine. It just, I don't really necessarily believe them when they're, the things they're saying, even to the point of getting absolutely ecstatic with the victory. They've had 2 hours to get the hang of the idea that, and a whole weekend and the weeks that went into it, with the idea that they might win. If they don't win, they'd be crying. And when they're winning, I think that the ecstasy that they display on the radio is a little bit too much. So yeah, yes, I think in summation, if I ever do get to sum up, Lando, he's proper disgruntled with good reason. I do kind of, I think there is something about the safety aspect of these cars that needs to be thought about for sure. But yeah, I think they'll get there sooner or later, and they won't be quite as far off.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of, I suppose, people adjusting and adapting to cars, and then speaking of, as you said earlier, the teams coming away with a lot more data. Perhaps no team coming away with more data than Aston Martin, who decided to bring in their cars and then bring them back out and then let them toddle around for a little bit. And at one stage, Fernando Alonso was 15 seconds behind the pack. I mean, you have those kind of sensationalist headlines of, we can't do more than 15 laps or they're going to risk permanent nerve damage. You're having headlines of staff shortages over in Honda. We didn't know there were staff shortages over in Honda. What's gone wrong for Adrian Newey, the sport's most successful designer?
Oh gosh, I mean, everything changes in a heartbeat. I mean, we saw this, didn't we, with McLaren about, what, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
much less, where they, I mean, it was a catastrophe. I mean, they were, everything was horrible. They were the slowest thing in the universe. It was all, and within a couple of years, they're back at the top of the tree again. The resource is there for Aston Martin. Is the time there? It all depends on the patience from Lawrence Stroll. What's gone wrong from Adrian Newey? He came in relatively late to the project. I mean, we look at the performance of Audi, I mean, straight in and in the points, albeit, you know, they had their challenges as well, but that was a stunning performance. But then they've had they were the first one of them, I think probably the first to sign up to the new these new engine regulations when they were first proposed, and it's why they came in. So they had years to really get going on their project for their power unit. A little bit different for Honda, as you say. They let a lot of people go from there, and you know, apparently Aston Martin didn't know about it, so that looks like a due diligence effort issue from Aston Martin's point of view. But from Adrian Newey's point of view, he's relatively late to the party in terms of technical director. I would be a little bit concerned that he might be distracted by the team principal role.
That was what I wanted to ask you about, because it seems like if you have Adrian Newey, you should be letting him be the designer and devote all of his time to giving you the best car possible, as opposed to leading the team.
He never seemed like a front of house kind of guy to me, so I almost feel like he's been semi Peter principled into this one, or there's just a lack of someone else to take on that role. So I find that's a little bit of a concern, because it's a leadership role. You're the general. You need to rally the troops. You need to keep everyone motivated and interested. But by the same token, it's also not ceremonial, but so much of your time is. You're distracted from the nuts and bolts business of leading an engineering team on every particular strand of activity that goes into actually creating a winning car, and that's where he needs to be. So I've always imagined him really as a technical director. Again, I'm not in the middle of it, but I have been to the Red Bull technical department, and he's there on his old 45 degree drawing board, you know, doing it old school, and meanwhile there's banks and banks of computers and people beavering away, and you always imagine him as this boffin, this engineer that lives in almost an ivory tower, aloof from the rest of the engineering team. I'm sure he's not that. I'm sure he does go and assemble around him the right brains trust and does get dirt under the fingernails to create the project, but I can't imagine that he really needs to be in team principals meetings talking about, you know, the politics of Formula One, all that rubbish. That's quite the distraction and the diversion. So I kind of hope someone takes that away from him. But I don't think it's necessarily his catastrophe. I mean, they are really struggling. I thought it was funny. Alonso is funny, isn't he? The way he said, "No, I could have done the whole Grand Prix if the car was fast." So yeah, you got a lot of vibration in the car, but I think I probably could have managed it if the car was capable of going fast enough or long enough. It's a really, really tricky situation, difficult situation for Honda and Aston Martin, but this too shall pass, isn't it? Eventually they'll bounce back from this.
And Declan, there are rumours that Christian Horner could make a return and become that team principal at Aston Martin. We know as part of his settlement with Red Bull that he's free to return to the Formula One paddock at May. Do you think that could potentially work? I mean, Horner and Yui have worked together for 2 decades at Red Bull. It's a proven duo that we know that works. Could that potentially be the missing piece that Aston Martin need right now?
I mean, Horner would be perfect for that job, wouldn't he? I mean, he's son of Bernie, definitely totally embedded in the political machinations of Formula One. He would be ideal. I sort of think he's still angling to try and take the, you know, those shares that are available with the Alpine team. So that's probably the more likely outcome for him. He's definitely, I don't think, finished with Formula One, and he's kind of gathering around him the sort of money that will allow him to invest in a team. That's the next step for him, rather than being the hired gun. He wants to be the owner. He's not going to be the owner with the Aston Martin team, but you're right, Adrian Newey showed him around the factory, didn't he? The new their brand spanking new, yeah, Jordan replacement factory in Silverstone towards the end of last year. He went for a little show and tell, and that was, I think that was interesting, and it was a little bit more than showing your old mate around the factory. Not even sure what mates they are, and whether, I mean, it has been said, hasn't it, that Adrian Newey just felt he had to get out of Red Bull when the atmosphere politically became toxic around all of the things that were happening with Christian Horner, and indeed the Verstappen family and Helmut Marko, and the whole thing just sort of became a bit of a mess, and he didn't like that. So yeah, it would be really useful for Adrian Newey to have a team principal like Christian Horner, but I'm not sure it's the right fit for Christian Horner. Time will tell.
Because I suppose Aston Martin, if you're thinking of the political distractions on the grid, have more than their fair share. I mean, you have the Lawrence Stroll is the owner, and then his son Lance is a seemingly permanent driver on the grid whose seat is never in doubt. And then you have a driver like Fernando Alonso, who, like, as you said, he's a funny driver, double world champion, and when he came to Aston Martin in that 2023 season, so successful right off the bat with that car. And there's been all these retirement rumours around Lewis Hamilton, but no one really seems to mention Fernando Alonso that much, he'll just keep on racing forever. But to go through another round of horrors with a Honda engine, I mean, he's well into his 40s now. What must he be thinking?
Yeah, there aren't enough deck chairs for him at this point. For his, what must he be thinking? Mid-40s. I am constantly gobsmacked by the motivation of both Fernando Alonso and Lewis Hamilton. I think it is absurd to call Lewis Hamilton anything other than the greatest of all time, or in the top two or three, just by very dint of his ability to just keep going to the well week in, week out, year in, year out, potentially damaging his legacy if he gets hammered by Leclerc in qualifying throughout the year this year. We'll see how that one plays out, but they just impress me. I don't know why they would need it. Surely there's something else in their life. Is it the bit extra or the bit missing, they often say with these guys? I think they're both absolutely amazing, and I think Fernando Alonso is almost equally amazing, you know, in comparison to Lewis Hamilton. A couple of dodgy career decisions, I think, and he might have been sort of nudging around the 5 World Championships mark as well. I think it's the tantalising prospect that just maybe there might be a couple more Grand Prix wins, or maybe something more in there. you know, lightning can strike in the craziest of places. Braun GP won the 2009 championship. Where did they come from? I mean, it was the Honda. You know, it was the Honda team, wasn't it? I mean, Honda. So when Honda pull out, then you know, Fernando Alonso and friends will be ready to take advantage of it. I know I'm being a little bit facetious, but I think that's it. I mean, he sees Adrian Newey, he sees Lance Stroll with a blank check. He sees the excitement of so many other aspects coming in. They've got a works engine. Why not? But then he won't be backward about, and this has in some respects been part of his strength and also part of his maybe Achilles heel, is that he won't be backwards about telling everyone exactly what he thinks if it's not improving at the rate that he feels it ought to be. By the same token, he won't be backward about telling the world either, or at least making it known. And it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. But yeah, the graph of improvement will tell you whether Fernando Alonso has a 2027 season in him. If it's Alpine and it's in the right direction, then yeah, I mean, if they're starting to finish races, if they could potentially nudge around midfield by the end of the year, yeah, he'll be up for it for sure.
So kind of switch from the likes of Hamilton and Alonso, who've been racing for over 20 years now, to go to the only rookie on the grid. I know that Kira, you were very impressed by our rookie this year.
Incredibly, yeah. Lindblad is absolutely something else, isn't he? Where did he get that gusto from? You know, he was racing wheel to wheel against the likes of, you know, Lewis and Max on his first ever race. It was absolutely incredible. What do you think the future holds for Arvid Lindblad?
Yeah, really positive. To drop in like that and be able to go, I mean, you need to these days, don't you? They become fully formed. There's half a grid of Formula 2 drivers that think, whoa, if I had a chance in that car, I'd be right there. So please do. So, and they have a bit of a conveyor belt into and out of that particular drive. Yeah, I mean, didn't out qualify his teammate, but stuck it into the points. So that's got to feel, he's got to feel good about that. With two teenagers in the top 10, didn't we? Two teenagers and a 20-year-old. I mean, it's remarkable the way the grid has got younger and younger over the years. I think the idea that he's not afraid to go wheel to wheel with the very best of them is not a surprise, really. I mean, they're just, they're programmed to fight. It's very few of these drivers these days, and I'm constantly impressed by just how fully formed the drivers are when they arrive in Formula One. With just the odd exception, they generally speaking are able to slot in at a level of performance that allows them to stay in there for an extended period of time. If anything goes wrong to begin with, though, they're out really quickly. If things are not quite playing, I mean, we saw that with Doohan. I think he was badly treated, really, but you know, if anything's gone even remotely wrong, I think Colapinto, were it not for an awful lot of backing from Argentina, could well also be struggling, although he's got some reactions, isn't he? He gave us the reel of the race, and I think that sort of you know, again, refers a little bit to what Lando Norris was talking about with the difficulty with the new regulations. But I think Arvid Lindblad, I wasn't surprised to see that he wasn't afraid to go wheel to wheel with his heroes and with the people that he, you know, was watching that got him interested in the sport in the first place. We'll see if he can back it up. It's a long season, but so far a really encouraging start. Yeah.
And like you say, Red Bull aren't afraid as well to get rid of their second driver at a moment's notice. Obviously, Isaac Hadjar had such an unfortunate start to the season, and could we potentially, if he can't kind of, although Max didn't have an exactly fantastic start,
it's
either
a bittersweet start for Red Bull.
It was,
I think. But I think Hadjar's qualifying performance was sensational. I thought it was a really very mature performance. And I think that's the word I'm taking from both RB and Red Bull so far, the young drivers, incredibly mature qualification and incredibly mature race. Obviously, just unfortunate that
and
they had
fearless
that.
Fearless as well. Like, yeah, their elbows have been out.
And I suppose what I want to look at for Red Bull, sorry, I've hijacked your question.
No.
What I want to look at for Red Bull is that we know they're not the fastest car on the grid right now. That's never really mattered for Max Verstappen. And they're building around them right now some very mature, fearless young drivers. Can that kind of make up for the fact that they couldn't mind to have the straight line speed of Mercedes and Ferrari right now?
They've never cared whether there was a good second car. I mean, it seems to me like they're the only team on the grid that isn't completely obsessed with the Constructors' Championship to the exclusion of the Drivers' Championship. And, well, certainly in recent years, at any rate, they weren't that bothered when Sergio Perez wasn't able to equal Max Verstappen until it just became a little bit untenable. Isaac Hadjar just jumping in and, you know, sticking it second row. And meanwhile, Verstappen sticks it in the wall. That was a little bit of a sort of a change in role, wasn't it? A bit of role reversal there. It will be interesting to see how Max Verstappen responds to having a quick teammate. It'll be interesting to see whether Hadjar is able to back this one up with a little bit of consistency, and whether the team will enjoy the environment of having two fast ones, because it is a tough balancing act to have two fast drivers. We've seen plenty of teams that have failed to do it. Lots of teams aren't all that bothered if they've got one mega star and one not so great number two driver. I suppose Aston Martin's a pretty good example of that for slightly different reasons. Usually a team wants to see two fast ones because they want to make sure that they're finding out exactly what the true potential of the vehicle is, because naturally a driver is going to settle into a role where he thinks he's going as fast as he possibly can. He thinks he's extracting the maximum out of the car, but it's only when another driver drops in who's absolutely flying that he realises he's got to go a little bit deeper into the well to find something special. It's remarkable, isn't it? Human beings are the most irritating variable for any engineer, because they're just difficult to predict and difficult to, you know, you want to put 10,000 volts through them sometimes, don't they, to try and sort of rev them up to get what you need out of them. Hadjar, again, if he backs that up, it can only be good for the development of the vehicle. But will Max Verstappen be able to handle a scenario where he's not always the king of the castle? That's one to watch, yeah.
And what does this season hold for Max at a glance? Obviously, we're only a race in, but we know that Max doesn't like the new regulations, this new era.
He's gone to Nürburgring 24 hours. Yeah. That's the main focus, isn't it?
He's said that it's like Formula E on steroids. He's really not happy, but he was our driver of the day. He went from 20th on the grid to 6th. What do you think is going to happen? But we saw him last season. He was able to really come from behind towards the end of the championship, and he was almost, you know, he was very close to nabbing it off Lando Norris. So we obviously shouldn't be counting him out yet, although it does look like it is going to be a Mercedes Ferrari, you know, dominated season. What do you think we can expect from Max throughout this season?
I don't think he's walking away from Formula One anytime soon. I think that he feels how he feels about about those cars, and he's right to express it. He certainly is a key opinion former in the series, isn't he? And in the world of motorsport, I can understand how he feels about the whole sort of Mario Kart thing, or Formula E on steroids, or whatever we're calling it this week. But he's he isn't going anywhere anytime soon, especially if that car starts to develop. And I do believe that they will all get a little bit closer as the season goes on. Looks like, you know, I still think Mercedes have a step. I still think that there was a bit more in hand if, you know, had Ferrari sort of taken it, you know, had Hadjar not actually stopped, if they'd done their bungee cord racing for a little bit further into the race, it might have been interesting to see how it would have developed, especially if they'd had a more sort of established or a more sort of obvious pattern to pit stops as planned, you know, if they'd done their proper schedule. So I think the sort of, yeah, it's Merck, Ferrari a little bit tiny fraction behind, and then there's nothing to choose really between McLaren and Red Bull. That one's not really established, is it? And there's one or two other teams that might think that they can nudge in there as well. But I think that Verstappen is going to be battling for third, fourth positions quite soon, as early as next weekend. He's won at Shanghai, isn't he? So, you know, in 24. So I think, yeah, for sure, he'll be there or thereabouts. And I don't think he's walking away from Formula One at the end of the year, even if he wins the Nürburgring 24 hours.
And kind of speaking, I suppose, of Shanghai, looking ahead to next week, it's going to be a very different race. It's a very different circuit. I know that, I mean, Kira, we were chatting earlier about how long is the straight? Is it over a kilometre?
Yeah, 1.1 kilometres. That's the longest straight in the calendar.
So it's going to, the battery deployment is going to be entirely different to it was in Albert Park. And teams have a lot less practice to do. There's a sprint race on the Saturday. So you have one practice session for teams to get a hang of what their battery deployment is going to look like, what their qualifying is going to look like, and then they're right into the action. is this a bad time for a sprint race to fall, or will it actually, if anything, a good time?
Just get I'm excited anyway.
Straight into the action.
Well, listen, anything that makes it difficult, anything that makes it challenging for the teams are constantly complaining about sprint races because they take it away from their usual accumulation of data and engineering sort of Excel spreadsheet sort of, you know, fight off. I mean, it's but that's not what we're interested in. That's not, as fans, we want to see them go wheel to wheel as often as possible. I would like the sprint race grid to be decided by reverse of championship order, and then the order of the race to be based on the result of the sprint race. And let's have, you know, change the mix a little bit. I mean, again, everyone's spluttering into their gin and tonic at the idea of sort of doing away with the old style qualifying. But, you know, if we're introducing massive change to the regulations with the new hybrid formula and active aero and all sorts of crazy stuff like that, then why not, you know, dabble with the sporting regulations as well? And I think they needed to, you know, when they introduced the sprint race, I think it would have been great if they'd really gone the full hog and made it reverse grid, and we could have seen some proper overtaking and an incentive to overtake, you know, via the points that they offer. And we see that, don't we, in Formula 2 and Formula 3 and other sporting series as well, where the reverse grid format with proper motivation for the drivers in it can produce some fascinating racing. So, yeah, I don't mind that they're slightly, you know, distracted by a sprint race. You're right, accumulation of data, new racetrack is going to be fascinating. Although everyone's saying that it won't be quite as on a knife edge as Melbourne, that's one of the really tough ones, along with Monza and one other, I think, that, you know, that they're the ones that are going to be really challenging in terms of energy and management and deployment. But yeah, there's a long straight, isn't it? And when do you press the button? When do you, you know, how exactly are you super clipping at the end, or are you, you know, lift and coast? And there's a lot to be decided, yeah.
Exactly that. And it's only, you know, the sprint is a 19 lap sprint. We know that it's going to be really important who starts off quickest. And now with Ferrari, with this turbocharger, we saw how quick they were to get off the mark. We saw how quick Lewis was to make up those positions. Do you think they'll have the advantage over Mercedes during that sprint? Do you think they could really determine, you know, they could really set this race up for themselves?
Yeah, no tyre change. So, yeah, first off, the line ought to be able to protect. And Lewis Hamilton qualified first and finished first, didn't he, in the sprint last year? Yep. So we thought he was going to have a great year in Ferrari. Didn't quite work out like that. And of course, then they got disqualified, didn't they, afterwards with the plank wear. So yeah, it wasn't exactly a great conclusion to the weekend for Ferrari, but it isn't a bad track for them. It's a great track for Lewis Hamilton historically, and it's funny how you do get DNA, you do get horses for courses, and there is a sort of, you know, you do see these patterns emerge, even if we had that huge gap between the sort of early Shanghai Grand Prix and then the sort of, you know, they only came back to the track in the last couple of years. So yeah, I think it could be one for Ferrari. Again, that comes with the sort of huge asterisk that this is such a revolution in the rules this year, that carrying that DNA that we often see from year to year, that habit of going well at some tracks and not going so well at other tracks, is likely to be skewed a little bit by the fact that these cars are completely new. But yeah, some drivers like certain tracks, so it will be, I think, one that Lewis Hamilton is certainly looking forward to, yeah.
And then I just suppose lastly, Declan, before we let you go, speaking of upcoming tracks, it's looking, I might say increasingly likely, but I'm not sure I'm going to go that far, but it's looking pretty likely that Bahrain and Jeddah, there could be no choice but to cancel them, if only for trying to get equipment in and out of the Middle East because of the war at the moment is going to be an incredibly difficult task, and far too like last minute to arrange any kind of replacements or alternate tracks or anything like that. I suppose what will this mean? Is this probably likely to happen? And then will they just have to have a month of nothing between after Japan?
I know. I mean, yeah, go sim racing, yeah. That's definitely what Max will be doing, that's for sure.
Yes.
I think there's a fair chance they will. Well, I'll tell you what, they will take it right to the last minute to try and run those races, because they've got massive contracts, huge money tied up. They've got huge contractual commitments there that they need to be met. They'll go to those races if they possibly can. If they can't, then it's almost impossible in the modern era to replace those events. There was a time, I mean, I can remember going to Brands Hatch for European Grand Prix, that was a replacement you know, they remember the Donington Grand Prix as well, 93. There's a couple of races at Brands and several races over the years that have gone to different racetracks at relatively last minute. So, but it's much, much, much more difficult now. And even in the COVID era, it was easier to sort of hash together a world championship at 10 minutes notice if nobody was going into the venue. But if you've got to get all of that, you know, equipment for the cars, all of the equipment for the race organisers, for the FIA, for everything around broadcasting it, and let people in the gate, then it's just really difficult to publicise it in advance to make sure you've got all your personnel in place, you've got all of your the amount of safety plans, etc., that are involved. It's a huge undertaking to replace a race at short notice, and there's no way they're going to run the race into an empty venue, because where's the incentive for any promoter that would take that on? Why would any racetrack do that? Because that's where they make their meager millions, really, is on the gate, isn't it? So it's tough to see a replacement. Potentially you could put something at the back end of a season, but if it ends in December, how do you do that? Do you put it into the 3-week gap mid-season? I suppose there's a few conversations you could have around that, but at the moment I'd say they'll run it to the last minute, and there's a good chance that we're not going there.
I think that's a very Formula One answer of leaving everything to the very last minute and then we'll see. Listen, Declan, thank you very much for joining us today. This is a fascinating conversation. And as always, the F1 pod on Off The Ball is brought to you by KitKat, bringing breaks to the fastest sport in the world. Hashtag have a break. Thank you very much and hope you have a good day.
Cheers, Eve. Cheers, Kieran.
Thank you.
The Formula One pod on Off The Ball, brought to you by KitKat. Hit pause, have a break, have a Kit Kat. Button.